16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, world leaders look to a fresh start in relations with the United States.
The idea that there will be a sort of a new deal, a new partnership.
Another somber milestone in the number of coronavirus deaths in the U.S.
I think it is out of control at present and will continue to be out of control in the foreseeable future.
Also ahead, how a four-legged family member of President-elect Joe Biden will be going from homeless to home in the White House. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump continued posting accusations of voter fraud on Twitter this week, something the social media platform flagged as being in dispute. With Joe Biden the projected winner of the 2020 election and recognized by nearly every domestic news organization and world leaders as the president-elect, how do the president's recent actions affect the media, the office of the president, and the transition to the next administration? To tackle those subjects, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with Stephen Farnsworth, professor of political science and international affairs and director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Ultimately, the courts are the arbiter of the president's claims. And so far, the president's arguments that there is no fairness in this election process has been rejected by the courts. State after state, federal and state courts have rejected the president's claims. And so it is becoming increasingly difficult for the president to maintain that this election was improperly run. I think at the end of the day, it'll be clear from court rulings that this process, while a little more contentious than the evidence would suggest it should be, will be resolved in a way to demonstrate that Democratic outcomes provide Democratic victories to the candidates who do win.
With President Trump still making these accusations, does that harm American democracy in any way?
Well, I think it's important to note that a lot of the president's supporters are accepting the president's argument that there was some misconduct involved in these elections. Increasingly, people consume news within media silos where they can get evidence that is very supportive of the point of view that they start with. That's really, really dangerous for democracy. I think, though, that as the world looks at the United States, they're going to see a process that maybe is a little bit messy in November and December, but in the end, people will demonstrate in this system that the winners actually do end up in power. I think it would be better for American democracy if the losers accepted losing more readily than they do. And that normally is how the process works here. I think it's important to remember that what's going on right now with President Trump and his refusal to concede is really, really different from the way Democratic and Republican candidates both over most recent election cycles have conducted themselves. I think this will be seen in retrospect as an aberration, not as the new normal. Winners win, losers lose, and everybody accepts the outcome. That's the norm, and that's likely where we'll return in the United States once we move past this next few weeks.
You mentioned a period of uncertainty in November and December before the next administration is sworn in. But the American government still has business it needs to conduct both domestically and abroad. With the uncertainty concerning the Trump administration not conceding the election yet, does that pose a problem to America's diplomatic efforts overseas?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. One of the key bipartisan sources of agreement in terms of the conduct of U.S. foreign policy over the last 70 years has been democracy promotion. Democratic and Republican presidencies alike have really, really committed a huge amount of investment politically and financially in terms of advancing more civil society, more democratic development around the world. And the Trump presidency has really been an aberration in that respect. And it is more difficult, I think, for democratic forces to find support in this current administration with respect to the embracing of many countries that are less than democratic. People might get the idea that democracy activists have been limited in their ability to get U.S. support. But all indications are that Joe Biden will return American foreign policy to the bipartisan norm of an aggressive, vigorous international presence for the United States and the promotion of greater democratic reforms around the world.
Stephen Farnsworth, director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The 27-nation European Union foreign ministers will be holding a video conference today to address a way forward with the new U.S. administration, their views on multilateralism, and other pressing international issues. It follows a recent published opinion article by the French and German foreign ministers written specifically for the U.S. news publication The Washington Post about the prospects of a new deal of sorts for transatlantic unity on common issues. Joining us now to talk more about it, Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what is the message these ministers are trying to convey?
There is a feeling in Europe, particularly in France and Germany, that vital issues such as climate change, Korea, Russia, arms embargoes, everything like that has not really been dealt with. And what the two foreign ministers have put forward is the idea that there would be a sort of a new deal, a new partnership to look at these particular issues. And there's one side that comes from the fact that there's been a lot of talk in Europe that a Biden administration would be just like the old days, would be an Obama administration number two, as opposed to, on the other side, you've got people saying, well, no, the world has changed a lot since Obama was president, and everything needs to be put on a new path. And the new path they're looking at, particularly in this op-ed that those two foreign ministers wrote, is that together they can deal with issues such as China, because this has been an issue which the Europeans have felt very much left out on, that they've been trying to deal with this country that has just not had anything in common when it has come to a rules-based society. So that's what they're aiming for, that's what they're hoping for, and by placing an op-ed like that in something like the Washington Post, then that means that they are going to make sure the people in Washington hear that.
Is what these foreign ministers are saying, does that resonate and reflect what the leaders of those countries feel as well?
Very much so. Just last week, French President Emmanuel Macron, in an interview, talked about Europe needing to have its own strategic autonomy. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has been talking about Europe needing to take its fate into its own hands. So very much this notion that Europe should be, on the one hand, a partner with America, but on the other, should be having more of its own autonomy to be able to be an equal rather than be dependent on the U.S.
And what sort of response are they expecting from the new administration?
On the one hand, there's a real acknowledgement here in Europe that domestic issues will play a big role in the new administration. On the other hand, a lot of European leaders do know President-elect Joe Biden from his time, not just as vice president, but also more recently, he has been coming to Europe. He's attended the Munich security conferences. So there is a long-standing relationship. There's also a sort of a natural affinity between them. But certainly what the Europeans are looking at is that they are hoping that there will be an administration that will be more liberal, will have more democratic values, that are on the same lines as European leaders, and if not on the same lines, that at least there are liberal democratic values that they feel comfortable with. And with President Donald Trump, they really haven't felt that comfortable.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. The World Health Organization says there were nearly 4 million new coronavirus cases reported globally last week, with Europe accounting for nearly half that number. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
In its latest COVID-19 pandemic analysis, the UN Health Agency says that for the first time in more than 3 months, cases in Europe have dropped about 10%, suggesting that recent lockdown measures across the continent are having an effect. Still, WHO says the number of deaths in Europe increased substantially. Significant spikes in cases and deaths were also seen in the Americas. Southeast Asia is the only region that's seen a drop in cases and deaths. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United States reached a sobering milestone Wednesday in the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The confirmed death toll surpassed 250,000 as the virus rages at an unrelenting pace. While there has been good news this week about two vaccine trials reporting higher than expected effectiveness, conditions inside the nation's hospitals are deteriorating as exhausted healthcare workers search for open beds in other facilities. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in the U.S. has doubled in the past month and set new records every day this week. Joining us now is Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease physician at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and current medical director with the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. He has also served on the executive board for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thank you for being with us. We just heard about the situation in Europe, but where does the U.S. stand in comparison?
I think we're rivaling Europe at the present time, and the same thing is happening on both sides of the Great Atlantic. Namely, people are going out to group events, not paying attention to social distancing and not wearing masks. They wish to return to the old normal. And there's COVID fatigue out there. And those grouped events are accelerated. The virus is spreading among people who attend the group event, and then they go home, and the virus spreads further at home, and thus the virus keeps spreading, really, in a rather uncontrolled fashion now.
Do you see this getting worse with the holidays, with the colder weather in the coming months, regardless of any hope of a rapid vaccine?
Well, I'm very worried that the holidays here in the United States will accelerate this further because people will gather together and behave the way they've always done. That's normal. But it's a group event. People will be giving thanks and be giving the virus at the same time, I'm afraid. Mm. And we'll spend more time indoors because it's cooler and indeed will get cold. And once again, that's an environment conducive to spreading the virus. We'll wait for a vaccine, and we may indeed start vaccinating toward the end of the year, and certainly in the beginning of the year, everything going well. But it will take months and months and months before the frequency of the vaccination out in the population will affect the transmission of this virus.
Do you see this pretty much out of control at this point in time?
I think it is out of control at present and will continue to be out of control in the foreseeable future. Now, governors around the country are instituting restrictions of one sort or another in an attempt to curtail spread, and some of those may indeed have some local impact. We can only hope. Several of us are imploring our governor to put in a statewide mask mandate at the present time. We'll see if we have any effect. Not yet. So I think we're in a quite perilous situation. This has been called the greatest public health hazard to affect the United States since the 1918 monstrous influenza pandemic. I think that's true. I don't believe that's an exaggeration.
Do you think that by the time a new president is sworn in on January 20th, it's not like he's just going to suddenly be able to get it under control at that point?
With a potentially different approach or new policies?
There'll be nothing sudden about this. This will be like turning the proverbial ocean liner, slow and persistent to turn things around. Some of the attitudes about mask wearing and notions about the pandemic are so baked in and have such a political veneer that those attitudes are very, very hard to change.
And what about these two potential vaccines that we've been hearing about coming out? How quickly, even though we're hearing, like you just said, maybe some of them will start being given at the end of December, what's the realistic timeline on all of this? And can we really believe they're that effective?
I do believe we can believe they are that effective. It seemed from the beginning that both vaccines were going to be over 90% effective once the data started to come in, and that made all of us smile. Effectiveness at that level had not been anticipated. So there is light at the end of the tunnel, but it's still a long tunnel. We'll have to do a lot of work to get there. I do think that by the end of the year, certainly the beginning of January, we ought to be able to start vaccinating. We'll give it first to healthcare providers who are taking direct care of COVID patients, people who work in nursing homes, emergency medical technicians, and those kinds of folks, the first responders. And then we'll open it up gradually to others. Over time, there will be a prioritization. We can't vaccinate everybody in a week and a half, and everybody will have to stay tuned when it comes their time to be vaccinated. But people will have to be convinced. There's a lot of skepticism about these vaccines, and I think the data are going to be so solid. And my prediction is those vaccines will be supported by medical and public health professions, and that will reassure the average person and will begin to persuade them to get vaccinated. Because if we and who wear white coats get ourselves and our families vaccinated, that ought to say something.
Absolutely. Do you think there's any sort of realistic timeline that people can think about as far as any semblance of normalcy?
The timeline is going to be long, unfortunately, because it will take a long time to try to vaccinate 330 million people in the United States. I would think that by midsummer, going into the fall, things could get back to some degree of normalcy. And I would hope that next Thanksgiving, we'll have near normal family celebrations again.
Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease physician and professor at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, who has served on the executive board for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thank you for being with us. A rocket attack by pro-Iranian militia appeared to target the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad's Green Zone overnight. The attack has ratcheted up tensions between the U.S. and Iraq, just as the two countries announced the withdrawal of 500 more U.S. soldiers from Iraq. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi media reported that 7 Katyusha rockets were fired at Baghdad's fortified Green Zone and that they were apparently aimed at the U.S. Embassy compound. No U.S. casualties were reported, but Iraqi military officials say one child was killed and 5 civilians wounded by several stray rockets. A pro-Iranian militia group says it fired the rockets at the embassy in retaliation for what it alleged was the U.S. arrest of 3 of its members in the city of Fallujah, west of Baghdad. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. A spokesman for the main pro-Iranian Kataib Hezbollah militia denied responsibility for the attack, saying in a tweet that his group was observing a unilateral truce to allow a complete U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi told journalists Wednesday that the U.S. has agreed to pull out 500 of its forces from Iraq in a short period of time. He says that during his recent visit to Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump agreed to withdraw from Iraq within the year, and we just agreed to a pullout timetable for U.S. forces with our American counterparts. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein gave journalists further details. He says that after consultations between Prime Minister Kazemi and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo 2 days ago, they agreed to cut U.S. troops by 500, bringing down the total number of non-combat U.S. military forces to 2,500. Egyptian analyst Raad Azawi told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that the rocket attack overnight was an attempt by pro-Iranian militia forces to embarrass Iraqi Prime Minister Kazemi and to show that they can hit American targets if the U.S. decides to attack Iran. He added that Israeli planes also targeted pro-Iranian militia forces in Syria shortly after the Baghdad attack. The New York Times reported earlier this week that President Trump had considered attacking Iran's Natanz nuclear enrichment facility, but that his advisors had persuaded him not to do it. Dr. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that withdrawing U.S. forces from Iraq is perceived by Iran as a victory. He says it is a volatile and brittle part of the world, and in the cultures of the region, such a withdrawal can likely be seen as a retreat. The enemies of the U.S., he adds, will be thinking, if we just wait out the Americans, they will leave, and we can go back to what we were doing. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. aviation regulators say Boeing's 737 MAX is clear for takeoff after 2 years of being grounded following a pair of deadly crashes. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The planes were grounded worldwide last year after two crashes within 5 months killed 346 people. Investigators had focused on anti-stall software as a cause. Federal Aviation Administration Chief Stephen Dixon lifted the grounding after a 20-month review, telling CNBC Squawk Box the software's been redesigned and the MAX is now safe.
And I would put my own family on it.
Still, Dixon says the FAA will inspect every new MAX before letting them fly.
But Michael Stumo, whose daughter Samia died in the second 737 MAX crash, tells the Associated Press it's hard to trust the Federal Aviation Administration and Boeing when they shroud the technical details of the plane's updates in secrecy.
They won't show us the technical data for the fixes, for the test protocols, for the hazard assessments, and that sort of thing, which is the same culture of secrecy as before. So trust us doesn't work. After Lion Air, they hid the risk assessment, projecting 15 more crashes. Boeing said it's the safest plane ever to fly the skies, and it crashed with our daughter on it a few months later.
American Airlines so far is the only U.S. carrier to put the Air Max back on its schedule. You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us, back in a minute. VOA.
Always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. It's been 4 years since a four-legged family member graced the halls of the White House, but with President-elect Joe Biden moving in come January, there will be not one, but two canine companion residents, Biden's German Shepherds, Champ and Major. In fact, Major, who the Bidens fostered before officially adopting from their local animal shelter, will be the very first rescue dog in the White House. Joining us now for why it has excitement for animal lovers is Dr. Sarah Nold, staff veterinarian with Trupanion, a U.S. pet insurance company. Thank you so much for being with us, Doctor. So there have been numerous books about the very topic of pets in the White House. Why do you think presidents and their pets has historically been such a fascination to Americans?
I think people are just fascinated by animals in general, and specifically with presidential pets, I think just like with other celebrities, it helps them seem more human and relatable, especially to other pet owners.
You know, with the pandemic, 2020 really did see a huge surge in fostering and adoption. It's really interesting in the age of coronavirus how it used to be where we'd hear about shelters overflowing and begging people to adopt. There's so many shelter dogs out there, and of course, also foster. And all of those things really have been surging. Interestingly enough, Joe Biden is bringing the very first rescue dog to the White House. How significant is this in and of itself to have the first rescue dog? Why is it a big deal? And will it, do you think, inspire more rescue and adoption?
I hope it will inspire people to get more rescue pets. There are many great pets out there that for whatever reason have been given up on and are looking for a home. And many of these have been already evaluated to determine what type of home or family would be the best fit to hopefully give them the highest rate of success. Rescuing these pets saves their lives from not only homelessness, but potentially from being euthanized in some situations. So it's a great thing for people to be aware of. And I think when they see somebody in the spotlight rescuing a pet, that it helps them realize that it's something that potentially potentially they should look into as well. So yeah, I do hope that it helps to increase adoptions of rescue pets. Not only are there the mutts or the mixed breeds in rescues, but there's also purebred rescues as well that they can look into.
Look at Joe Biden's dog Major. He's a German Shepherd. That's, you know, certainly a very popular breed of dog. It's also a really smart dog. What is this particular dog known for, and why is it sort of an iconic breed?
They're known for being very loyal and protective. They are a working dog, so they do require a quote-unquote a job or mental stimulation, lots of exercise and play. I think that considering these characteristics is important for anybody looking to adopt a dog, whether a purebred or a mixed. It's important to talk to your vet about which breeds may be the best fit for your family, because a German Shepherd may not be the best fit for every family. I think ideally they would be in more of an active family versus one that's when you kind of just lounge around all day. I do think it's important for people that are getting pets via rescue or breeder that they do their homework. They can get what has the potential to be a perfect pet either way, from a breeder or a rescue, but they can just as easily get a nightmare of a pet if they're not looking into not just the appearance of the dog, but also taking into account breed characteristics, as well as potential health concerns or hereditary conditions, which are more of a risk in a purebred than in a mixed breed dog.
And yeah, there is something about seeing a president that sort of brings them down to earth, like you were talking about earlier, to see them with their dogs just hanging out or sitting on their dog beds, or, you know, that takes them out of the Oval Office and just really sort of shows a human side to be with man's best friend. And it can probably get pretty lonely. I mean, we heard about Bill Clinton when he was having all his struggles at the White House, and the only friend he had was his dog Buddy. So what would you say to that as far as pets actually being an asset to former first families or any first family?
Definitely. I think they're an asset. Pets are known to help with stress and anxiety. And I can think of a few jobs that are probably as stressful as being in the White House. I think that pets also add an easy way to add those moments of kind of fun and some exercise in your days. They kind of force you. They come up, nudge your hand with their head, or you just look across the room and gaze in their eyes and realize, oh, maybe we should go for a walk. So it kind of gives you an excuse to have a little break in your day. I think also they, in the case of first families, they help provide a part of their home before being at the White House, something that is familiar. And I think being a home is more defined by the people and pets than the things that are around them. So it should make it feel more home-like for them as well.
Dr. Sarah Nold, staff veterinarian for U.S. pet insurance company Trupanion. Country icon Dolly Parton is being celebrated in song for her contribution to an experimental coronavirus vaccine, a rewritten version of her own song, Jolene. Northeastern University Associate English Professor Ryan Cordell posted a video on Twitter of himself performing a tweaked version of Parton's signature song renamed Vaccine that's drawn tens of thousands of views. The lyrics, vaccine, 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 I'm begging you, please go in my arm, vaccine, 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 please just keep me safe from COVID harm, were actually written by linguist and author Gretchen McCullough, who posted them online and invited people to record them. Dolly Parton's $1 million gift to Nashville's Vanderbilt University Medical Center helped researchers develop Moderna's experimental coronavirus vaccine that was announced this week. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us.